Buddhist guest here. But you know that I changed my attitude. We try to kill, you know, fly by honey instead of, you know, say, okay, that, I think that you see all the treaties signed by the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, what we call in our language, the ink is not, you know, dry, then they just tear away and put into the, you know, in the rubbish bin. And that the world's unreliable, or they are themselves unreliable. They are cynic. And then the word Doughton. Doughton, literally you say that struggle, such a very nice word. But though I will separate into words. One, though, that is to say to bet, to gamble. You bet, though, with you win or you lose. And ten, that is to involve in competition. Have to be first or second or so on. See, the two words is to together with Doughton. Doughton and the South Vietnamese, between the Vietnamese and Vietnamese themselves, they use the same word like Dr. Pike just say, but you a bit wrong in the way that they say Doughton in the South Vietnamese, they say that Trâu đánh, that is to say that buffalo, and then that means beat. You are beaten by the buffalo. You see that the North Vietnamese use one word, the South Vietnamese retort in another word, because they themselves, they don't like each other.
Like each other.
Now, the word, I think that inside here, you say that, okay, some percentage of mystification inside. Some part, you say that they are very clever and very good people and so on. They win the war. And you put that, for example, U.S. lack of determination. I agree with you. I agree that point. And about the word calcify, I think that calcify and the mystification, the myth is also calcify. So we have to do something to dissolve that myth about the Vietnamese and struggle and so on. And besides that, I do agree with you too about, you know, the China dilemma, that the more successful it is in continuing the resistance, that means the bleeding Vietnam white, and then at the same time, you know, the Vietnamization is going on in Cambodia too. Because I born in South Vietnam, I know what happened about the Khmer Krom. The Cambodian in love the part of Vietnam, that Vietnamization. But anyway, we still have 5 million. We still speak Cambodian, although we cannot write. Some of our brothers cannot write Cambodian, but they still speak. And we still have pagodas, 610 pagodas in the South Vietnam. So you see that we can have some more struggle.
Chung, can you wrap it up, because there are some other questions that...
Besides that, I think that the Vietnamese, they are excelled in, you know, mummifying Ho Chi Minh in order to use him, and still using him in the among the Vietnamese population. As Vietnamese, as Cambodian, I must precise here that we, between the people and the people, that okay. But between the leaders and leaders, KO.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Thank Chung Vili. Would you like to comment on that, Douglas?
No,
right. Okay. There's a question from behind. I will get around to you, Joe. Right.
Doug Pike is already aware of this question because we've discussed it before. But yesterday, Doug raised the question of what is the Vietnamese bogey? And I wonder whether he isn't raising a bogey himself when he presents the question of a federation of Indochina. He seems to have presented a kind of sinister escalation of Vietnamese talk on this subject and to have resurrected the federation idea. But it seems more an attribution of thinking to them rather than anything that's clearly demonstrated by what they say. They talked about a special relationship, and now they use the word alliance and confederation approach. And I think that the word consolidation, which Professor Scalapino has used, may be more descriptive. Maybe I'm being too academic, but I think the idea of a federation would be so against the grain of history with respect to these three nations and regions and areas that it would be very counterproductive for Vietnam to consider anything approaching a federation, that is, a single state, a single diplomatic corps, a common army, a common police force, language rights, a common budget. I just don't see that as being worth their attempting. And what they're doing instead is forming all kinds of tripartite committees, which coordinate things like economic planning, perhaps, and even military cooperation. But when you put the question in terms of the issue is whether we will accept the Federation of Indochina, it seems to me that that's not really likely to happen, and that your analysis of the minimal conditions that Vietnam would set for a settlement in Kampuchea is much more accurate and less frightening, more realistic. We've been over this before, but maybe you'd like to respond to it for the benefit of others.
Well, this may be a semantic quarrel. I think of a federation in terms of separate entities, and I think in the case of Hanoi or in the case of Vietnamese leadership, way back, the assumption was, in the days they were fighting the French, that the ultimate configuration for the peninsula would be French Indochina without the French, but that there would be three separate entities, and they would be confederated. I think the Vietnamese are minimalist in terms of the amount of control and influence they want to exert in Laos and Cambodia. I don't think they want to run these countries on a kind of detailed basis. They have, I'd argue here, certain minimal needs that are hypothesis. But I want to stress this is, we're moving from a position of ignorance. We do not know what the Vietnamese would settle for with respect to Kampuchea and Laos and what they would not. And the only other point I want to make was they did not go into Cambodia in the name of federation. This may become a self-fulfilling prophecy, but they went in to solve the Pol Pot problem. They believed they could do it in 6 months. And they failed, and now they're bogged down. But the point is that this was not imperial dreams that motivated them, although that does not negate the fact that these dreams exist. I still think, though, in the case of the Vietnamese, through the years, it's been more or less of an unexamined assumption that this would be the final configuration. And there's much to argue for that. Economically, it is an entity, Indochina.
Are you trying to say, Doug, that Vietnam has acquired its own Vietnam-type problem in Cambodia? Yes. Okay, you look tired. Joe Sasloff. He looks like he's battered. What's going on, Doug? Douglas?
Well, I want to add to the pessimism of this discussion, perhaps like the Vietnamese Doug described, and maybe to the churlishness, the academic churlishness that Ambassador Chowat referred to. I came on this trip to inform myself of the Cambodian situation, among other things, and I come away disappointed. Perhaps it was my naivete that I would hope I would find some sort of insight into solution, but I come away less finding that people are less disturbed than I thought they might be. I guess the Kampuchean issue for most of the key actors is not a terribly threatening one. In fact, I think there's an argument to make that each of the major actors sees an interest in continuing the status quo. For ASEAN, it's been a kind of a unifier that's helped a kind of common spirit. For China, it's a way to beat on Vietnam and to get a role in the ASEAN countries that it never would have hoped to get without this Vietnamese role. For the U.S., angry at Vietnam for its own defeat there and playing a rather modest role in this, it finds its interest served in a modest support of ASEAN in its goals. Even Vietnam, I think, is right now not under great stress and thinks that time is on its side. And the Soviet Union has its bases in Vietnam and its role in the area and its ships in the sea lane, so its interests are served. As one looks at the key actors, I don't see any who aren't served, except perhaps the Kampuchean people who are paying the costs of this. I'm so impressed, so impressed with the growing unity and inventiveness of ASEAN. Perhaps I was hoping for some kind of suggested solutions. Doug Pike has presented a kind of challenge to propose it. But I take it that the key strategy is that, one, there's Chinese pressure on the northern frontier of Vietnam and support for the insurgency in Laos and in Kampuchea. The economic boycott that the major nations are imposing on Vietnam. And the third element of that is to promote the Khmer resistance. Now, I find myself very sympathetic to the Khmer resistance. I spent some time on the border, and I was very moved. I think it's a just war, and I think that the Vietnamese domination of Kampuchea is unjust. But I came away with the feeling that the Khmer resistance is never going to amount to much and will not contribute much to, it will contribute very little, even as it improves, if one could assume it will improve. It will not get to the point, it seems to me, of making much of an impact on Vietnam. There is a danger, in fact, that it has a counterproductive impact, that it encourages the Vietnamese to dig in. Doug Pike's paper on the political culture of Vietnam suggests that would be their natural cultural reaction. Of course, they've got a pragmatic side, and if the costs were high enough, they're capable of pulling out. But in the meantime, if the costs aren't too high, they may continue the process of Vietnamization or just allow it to come by natural flow. Seems to me there is an inflow of Vietnamese. I don't gather it to be a deliberate campaign, but the borders are porous and the attraction in Kampuchea are great for the Vietnamese, and so there's an inflow of population and a digging in of the soldiers. The kind of resistance that one sees on the non-communist side is a symbolic battling at the base camps and great stress on those populations as the Vietnamese in the past couple of months have moved in and you see the evacuation. So that's not going to amount to much, but one hears with a variety of either cynicism or discouragement, that's the costs of this war. But if one comes to the conclusion that this will not contribute significantly. It seems to me, that is, this kind of resistance will not contribute significantly to changing Vietnamese policies. We've got to search for other kinds of alternatives. I'm disappointed that Professor Wananda didn't, I didn't read your paper, and I wonder if you've got other ideas or if there will emerge out of this conference, which has such a...
Yeah, he's going to talk about that tomorrow, I think.
Good. So, I guess I'll conclude by pointing out that though there are significant advantages to each of the major actors, it's worth reminding ourselves of the costs of the continued conflict in Kampuchea. There are, first of all, the human cost to the Cambodians who are struggling, and perhaps, and certainly in this resistance side, without much meaning. There's a continued tension and flow of refugees that comes out of this continued tension. There's a Chinese military role that disturbs many of the Southeast Asian nations. There's an increased Soviet role in the region because of this. So it's worth reminding ourselves that an early solution is better than a long-range solution.
Well, Joe, that's a nice speech that you made. But I'd just like to make a comment on the creeping colonization of the porous frontier. I think all of you have studied Cambodian and Vietnamese history. The Vietnamese, over the past 1,000 years, have the tendency to take over an area and then settle their soldiers in that area and make it their own. And perhaps that's what's worrying a lot of Cambodians and also the Thais. Now, I think there are 4 people ahead of you, Ambassador, so let's do it in sequence. Bob Scalapino is going to ask a question, then Carolina is going to ask a question. If Larry wants to ask his question, I'm going to wave it, Larry? Okay, you're next after the other two. Okay, Bob, I was waiting when you'd ask your question.
I first of all want to assure the ambassador that if he will stick around, he will find that the diversity in academic ranks is infinite. And I'm going to prove that now. Joe says that an early settlement is better than a long-term settlement. I would disagree. An early settlement can only be on Hanoi's terms. I think we ought to be coldly realistic about this. There is no settlement now except on Hanoi's terms. And I do not see any evidence that Hanoi is predisposed from any direction to be, quote, lenient or accommodating to interests other than its own. Nor do I agree, incidentally, with the thesis that the costs are more or less equal to all parties concerned. There are costs to all parties concerned. I would certainly agree with that. But let me suggest that if you talk about Hanoi's security interests, its long-term security interest can only be accommodated as it comes into some type of agreement with China. I repeat, with China. That is vastly more important than controlling Cambodia or Laos. And I myself, so one can argue and debate this, and neither side can prove their position. I repeat, with China. That is vastly more important than controlling Cambodia or Laos. And I myself, so one can argue and debate this, and neither side can prove their position. I do not believe that whatever ASEAN does or whatever we do, the PRC is prepared to accept a Vietnamese empire to its south. I think that there is absolutely no evidence of that. And they are not paying a high cost. They are not paying a high cost. they can accommodate a large number of troops on the Vietnamese border indefinitely, and they can use those troops to create border incidents. They can keep Vietnam permanently mobilized and at the same time highly dependent upon the Soviet Union. Now, I think that the Chinese have certain advantages in this situation. But let us assume for a moment that ASEAN were to make an agreement over or around or under China. A dissatisfied China with the new status quo would be far more dangerous to ASEAN than a China that was capable of interacting with some kind of compromise, ultimate compromise settlement in the region. Moreover, if you want to be Machiavellian about this, the most important issue between Russia and China today is Indochina. It's far more important in terms of the cleavage at the moment in Afghanistan or even the troops on the northern border. So if this issue is, quote, settled on Vietnamese terms, I do not see that this is of any great advantage to the ASEAN people or to us. And I think it opens up a whole new series of issues. Finally, let me just say that I don't think the present situation is advantageous to the Russians. On the contrary, and my own experience in talking with individual Russians confirms this, they are deeply apprehensive about the Indochina situation. One, because they do not trust the Vietnamese in the long term. They are quite certain that Vietnam will reassert an independence that will not be, in the long term, will not be interactive with the Soviets. But beyond that, in addition to paying a fairly heavy economic price for this conflict, they can never really normalize their relations with either ASEAN, or at least most of ASEAN, or the PRC under current circumstances. There is no great advantage to the Soviets in this current situation. And they know it. They're quite aware of it, in my opinion. Now, none of this is to set forth a solution. I'm going to save that till Friday. But I do want to challenge...
Another commercial, then.
I want to challenge some of the assumptions here.
Okay, and we're running short of time. We have 3 minutes left. So, Carolina, will you...
Yes, I'll take only most 1 minute, probably half. But right. This is just to assure Ambassador Chawat on two things. First, that the Philippine government's official position regarding Cambodia remains the same. That is to say, supportive of the ASEAN effort. We have not sent material assistance to Thailand in fighting incursions in the north because we are not in a fiscal position to do so, but I would like to remind the body about President Marcos's willingness to allow the bases to be used by the Americans should American active involvement in supporting Thailand be required. And number two, that there is no unity of academics around this room and also even in our own country, so our individual positions here as two academics from the same university should not be taken as the official academic position of Filipinos.
Well, I think that that Zamsel Palmieri wants to say something. I think it's quite clear. I think Ambassador Chawat wants to say something.
No, I think I just want to apologize to Mila if I had said anything offensive. I just wanted to mention that her views, which is very favorable to the Vietnamese, fortunately, is not the one held by the Yo government. Otherwise, we would have the Vietnamese occupation next to our border. So I just wanted to point out a very important point that John has said and partly answered by Professor Scolopino. You see, the problem is the seeking a solution, as rightly explained, is not one of urgency. One, I think, should not sacrifice basic stands for the sake of time. Of course, nobody wants the prolongation of this problem, but one should not seek a solution at all costs, and an early solution, and we agree with Professor Scalapino, that would be a one that would be imposed on Vietnam's term. And this, I don't think that we in Thailand, nor in ASEAN, should agree with. The other aspect I just wanted to make mention is that the suffering of the Cambodian people, we are very well aware of. But one element that perhaps one should think about is if, in theory, the solution as requested or as demanded by Vietnam is accepted, and I would like to stress in principle, what would happen to the people along the border? Would you think that the Vietnamese would accept them back into Cambodia? We, the Thais, would still be left with several hundred thousand of people along the border. We would have to handle that problem. I don't think we would be willing to do that. So in as far as choice is concerned, we don't have much choice. One can theorize, but when it comes to practical application, I think the choices are very limited as far as the government of Thailand is concerned. Thank you.
We'll give the last question to Ambassador Unger.
Thanks. I'd like to add just a few footnotes. It seems to me that on the question of whether there is a Russian-Soviet interest in the area, it does seem to me that there certainly is evidence today, particularly thinking about Kamran Bay and Da Nang, that there is a Soviet interest, one that I'm not saying that the Soviets would necessarily feel that they couldn't pursue their power interests and so on without this, but it does seem to me that it is a factor and one that something that they welcome. On the other side, I would dispute the idea that historical and geographical and other factors speak for Indochina, an Indochina unit. I don't think that's true. I think that the boundaries, however, whatever factors of that I've just mentioned you use, show a boundary down the mountain chain, the Annamite mountain chain that separates separates Vietnam from, on the other hand, Laos and Cambodia. I think that's where the boundary comes. It's a much more powerful boundary, and it's one that's been there, I think, much longer. So I think these are factors on both sides.
Well, thank you. Gentlemen, ladies. Before we break up, Clara, the famous Miss Clara, wants to make a few important announcements, very jejune to our present state of hunger, I think.
Mr. Kumban asked me to announce several announcements. For tonight's dinner, buses will leave at 6:45, and it will be very, very informal. For tomorrow, breakfast will be served at 6 o'clock, and we will leave hotel at 7 o'clock. At 11:30, we will have lunch at Cheng San, and 1 o'clock, we'll continue to Golden Triangle. About 4 o'clock, we are returning to Chiang Mai, and approximately get here around 7:30. And for dinner on the 10th of January, you are requested to wear the ISIS shirt. And I see Likit already wearing it. Why don't you ask as a model, Likit, please?
Yeah, how about extra large?
Yeah, it's coming more on Thursday. The largest available at the moment is size 48.
Well, that wraps it up. Thank you, Mr. Douglas Pike and Milo Espino. Thank you.
get back.